Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 99, section 6, which is old single column, page 1092. Okay, so we have these last two little sections here of our opening paper of the five papers in the block on the nature of religion. You'll recall that we went through that section on the social aspects of religion last week, and so completed our initial examination of exactly what you can begin to think about in terms of real religion, genuine religion as simply a purely inner life, purely individual fact, it inescapably is going to have at least a group manifestation, as they were talking about in that preceding section. Especially this early in the evolution of mankind, it inescapably is going to have some measure of socialization, but this is a social problems of religion paper, so they were wanting to stress that you can't let it just totally be pulled back down and out into a purely socialized phenomenon, or no matter how deep you start, you'll end up, as if you didn't start inside at all. You'll end up back with the phenomenon that we studied through all those papers on the evolution of religion. You'll just end up with that basic outer life, evolutionary quote unquote religion, with struggling to maintain any sort of inner life predicate, any sort of source of originality to be the seed for moving civilization forward. If all religion is distilling something out of the outer life and dragging it in and up, you're obviously not going to progress. Right? There's no engine within mankind itself for any advancement. You're going to depend upon being progressed in spite of yourself by just the slow evolution of the whole cosmic system and you being drug along with it a little bit. But that has its limits, as we've talked about so many times. So as we move into section 6 here, they want to to look again at this issue of, so you have that evolutionary religion, or you could say you have that socialized religion, if not fully, as the title of the section says, institutional religion. I mean, the longer it's socialized, the more there's going to be institutions that build up. And so just as in the preceding section, we were reminded that, you don't want to overplay this and think that somehow, you can totally let go of any sort of a socialization phenomenon. It's also the case that you can't You can't think that somehow we're going to magically snap our fingers and you're going to not have, you know, institutional religion either. Okay? So, but obviously, if you're going to consider institutional religion, you need to be very cautious about, you know, not letting the potential problems of institutional religion take a hold of it, right? You know, it's a very, very tricky problem to, you know, as they're going to point out here at the beginning, for that not to happen. Yeah, and so, yeah, but it does need to happen, okay, to some degree, all right? All right, so, as we get into this, let's keep that in mind. That, you know, they're going to give us, you know, great big lists of positives and negatives. Okay, but you know, we don't want to get lost in all those lists. You want to, keep in mind that bigger picture of on the one hand, you've got the pure inner life, genuine religion. And on the other hand, you're going to have some socialized, institutionalized phenomenon, but not letting it go too far. And as we go through these lists, you know, it's a combination of some of the things in the list are very much about the, you know, that basic inner life fact. Other things are taking it quite a ways, all the way to, a significantly institutionalized fact, you know, and they're not going to explain in each case, you know, which is which, you know, this item applies to this, this item applies to that. So you have to, reflecting on that the whole time. And sort that out yourself. Okay. Now, because these lists in here are so extensive, we're not going to go through every single one of these items. You'll want to sit down by yourself and sort of methodically step through and reflect on each of them. And that's another reason why I'm spending so much time up front, just kind of laying that all out, so that you can appreciate what you can get out of this section, because, you know, you might have a tendency to just kind of blow through it, because you're just reading, this item, this item, this item, this item, this item, okay? It doesn't look like it's a list because it's not itemized, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, right? But, you know, as we get into it, it's great, big, long sequences of specifics about, you know, both positive and negative relative to religion and its institutionalization. All right, probably more than enough said up front. Let's get into it here and see what we've got.
6. Institutional religion. Sectarianism is a disease of institutional religion, and dogmatism is an enslavement of the spiritual nature. It is far better to have a religion without a church than a church without religion. The religious turmoil of the 20th century does not, in and of itself, betoken spiritual decadence. Confusion goes before growth as well as before destruction.
Okay, so they start out gentle with a little predicate here. So, you know, notice that even in that first sentence, they're giving you two different aspects. Okay, on the one hand, you've got the very outer life issue of institutional religion. And, you know, it's one thing for there to be sects of that institutional religion, but the obvious tendency that there always is for, you know, the idea of your sect to be turned into an ism, right? And more and more you start to think that your sect is not only a complete lifestyle solution, but the complete lifestyle solution. Right? Okay, so that you've got that sectarianism on the one hand. And then we've already mentioned about the dogmatism. Remember specifically how to think about that. Don't think so much outer life issue with dogmatism. Right? Because you've got this, you know, these very, you know, pinned down, precise notions that the sect constructs. But they don't just dwell out there, right, on a piece of paper as dogma. You have great reverence attached to those key principles, and so you pull them in with your religious impulse, and you exalt them, whether you recognize you're doing it or not, to the very heights of your mind. Those dogmas get elevated up to the sixth level of meaning, up to the ceiling in your mind. Okay, and you know, literally make it so there's no place for genuine, objective religious consciousness to enter in and influence your mind, right? It takes the place, that religious dogma takes the place of genuine religious consciousness, effectively. You know, and it's only in extreme moments or times that, you know, that the dogma might have some competition from the cosmos. Okay, yep.
Well, trying to look at things in an evolutionary point of view, do we need better dogma, or do we need to just do away with dogma entirely? I mean, or is that a false either-or way of looking at it?
Can you do away with dogma totally? I mean, again, everything's an evolutionary process when you're talking about some socialized, institutionalized phenomenon. So initially, obviously, you're thinking about improving dogma and lessening the quantity of dogma. also, there's always going to be some in a church that can really wrap their minds around the purely inner life fact better, right? I mean, you know, they have more of a reflective life. And so talking about a purely inner life fact means something to them. And, I mean, the primitive person, you know, you can say reflective life until you're blue in the face. It doesn't mean anything. They're completely an outer life phenomenon. That's all they can even, you know, imagine. Okay, but you know, definitely those individuals in the group that can have all the more of a genuine inner life predicate, you know, they're you're going to be encouraging in them to not have any dogma up there at all. When I say that, you should be thinking, wait a minute, Chris, there's going to be a problem. I mean, how are you going to keep everyone on the same page in the group if there's varying degrees of identification with the dogma? And isn't that the an equal identification with the dogma, isn't that what keeps everyone together in the church, and you don't have a schism and turn one sect into two sects, right? The deal is you're not going to have the same modality to that church group as you have in the past. It's going to be much more dedicated to, as we talked about, that love-expanding fellowship phenomenon instead of the service-expanding fellowship. You know, and so the more that you can get it focused on the spiritual and not the material, right, differences of opinion become less and less of an issue. You can actually have different opinions in a group and not have that rip the group apart, because the group is not about uniformity of opinion. Right? So that's the basic challenge, and they've been talking about that already, to try to think about advancing what you call a religious group forward a bit, where it's less of a like opinion predicated group, right? And more of a genuinely spiritual group. And all the problems like we've talked about with that. It's like, well, what is a spiritual group? Like we say all the time, that's the question. No one has ever known what a spiritual group is, right? They call themselves spiritual groups, but they're not really spiritual groups. Right, they're feelingful social groups or something, there's this whole package that comes with this. In order to have this more advanced phenomenon, you need at least leaders that have the kind of full predicate that the Urantia book gives you, the whole cosmic picture, right? So that they can foster this more transcendent group that doesn't get bogged down in the things that it shouldn't get bogged down with economic ideas, social ideas, political ideas, right? All those opinion things, right? Okay, let's see now. We did one sentence. So far better to have a religion without a church than a church without religion. So that sentence is put in here up front. If it isn't obvious to you already, to remind you that when a church becomes so institutionalized and hence about the outer life, that it really doesn't have any genuineness of religious character to it anymore. As we've gone forward, that's now becoming a net negative phenomenon in society. Right? I mean, early on in the evolution of civilization, it was a net positive. Then it was kind of just a neutral thing. It's like, well, whatever. It's too bad it isn't more of a genuine religious thing. But it's now becoming more and more of a net negative. And they're saying, that if you have to go through a time when, when they say religion without a church, okay, I mean, that's genuine religion, that purely inner life thing, right? You know, and it's better to just have that and have no one be able to figure out how to really bring it together into any sort of a group phenomenon, you know, let alone something that kind of is institutionalized and is a church. I mean, it's better to not have anything like that for a little while until you kind of get your bearings a little bit better on a better predicate for a church, you know, than to just think, well, I'm just going to put new wine in old wineskins and make a new church, and, you know, it's not going to improve anything. It doesn't matter if you're inspired by reading your Rancho book to do it. You're going to end up with just this social service, you know, group thing again. And it's not actually going to help mankind. I mean, it's not that mankind doesn't need social service, but more and more and more social service is not going to advance mankind. That's not what's keeping mankind from progressing. You know, it's the lack of any originality, like I said up front, that's keeping man from progressing, right? And if there are no inner lives, there is no originality on the planet, right? There's cleverness, but not originality. And so nothing actually moves forward, right? It might appear to move forward, but really it's just sloshing around. It's not actually going to move forward. All right, so there's that sentence. Yeah, see, so they've got these three sentences, each kind of trying to give you a big picture. Like I was saying, before you get into these long lists of things here. And then we've talked about this, you know, this whole turmoil thing. They're reminding you that, yeah, religious turmoil, right, is not in and of itself, a fact that betokens spiritual decadence. You've got to, the only way to actually advance things is to go through a process of confusion as you let go of false initial assumptions and are hence confused about how to, you know, refound your, to get a new frame of reference. There's always going to be confusion, you know, for things to move forward as you transition from the old to the new. At the beginning of the 20th century, you know, you could still wonder if, well, maybe this turmoil is the kind of turmoil that is naturally sort of ending the material comfort era and moving into the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Well, yeah, we're 100 years hence now from the beginning of the 20th century. We can assess this a little bit better. Right, and we know what the answer is. You know you're quivering on the very brink, like they're saying. Confusion goes before growth as well as before destruction. You're quivering on the very brink, but of which one? Right? Actual advancement or an interregnum? Is there actual spiritual decadence? Is there just confusion? Or as it's played forward, is it shining forth as actual decay? And of course, it is decay. Less and less are these institutional churches about religion. More and more they're about social issues, you know, in particular social justice. Like we talked about with the Jews, you know, and how that's all they had was social justice until the exile in Babylon finally allowed them to discover religion for the first time. You know, it's a very tentative thing. Mankind has hardly been holding on to it over the last 3,000 years, and we're very much losing it. Right, we're in the Endarkenment. There is actual decadence. Things have gone down, you know, inside of us. All the more it's clear that it was wise for them to give us the Arantia book so that we at least have the possibility of pulling ourselves up out of this descent that we're in. You know, we have to face this. We can't continue to kid ourselves and say, no, there isn't spiritual decadence. We're very spiritual. Matter of fact, a lot of people have broken from the institutional churches, and they express that by saying, I'm spiritual, not religious. In other words, I'm spiritual, not institutionally religious. It's like, no, you're not really spiritual. I mean, that's the thing, right? Mankind doesn't know how to apply that word. Right? Just because you have feelings for your fellow man doesn't make you spiritual. It's because you'd like to help your fellow man, that in and of itself doesn't make you spiritual. It makes you caring. Okay. But, you know, you're a reacting phenomenon. You're not an acting phenomenon. You know, hence, you're not spiritual. You know, to say you're spiritual means that you're independent of the environment. You aren't this reactionary phenomenon. You originate action predicated on a cosmic perspective, you know, where you know that this will help mankind get in greater conformity with the cosmos, right? And it's not out there right now, and you're going to work on trying to introduce that originality into the system. Okay, let's get into this this first list here of the positive things to think about when you think about a new and improved institutional religion.
There is a real purpose in the socialization of religion. It is the purpose of group religious activities to dramatize the loyalties of religion, to magnify the lures of truth, beauty, and goodness, to foster the attraction of supreme values, to enhance the service of unselfish fellowship, to glorify the potentials of a family life, to promote religious education, to provide wise counsel and spiritual guidance, and to encourage group worship. And all live religions encourage human friendship, conserve morality, promote neighborhood welfare, and facilitate the spread of the essential gospel of their respective messages of eternal salvation.
Okay. So you get the great big long list there, not as long as the one that comes in the next paragraph after, but, right? Nonetheless, look at how strongly it starts, okay? I mean, they couldn't be more definitive that you don't want to think in some hyper-purist way about getting rid of all socialized religion. Okay? It has a role in the evolution to supremacy. Hence, it has, through the whole, a relationship to eternity. Hence, it has a real purpose. Okay? When they say, to use the word real and purpose, you know, just adding to that. Okay, so it's something that no matter how many warts institutional religion tends to have, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's actually a baby there. Right? That's what the real purpose is telling you. So let's look at, you know, just look at some of those. And you notice that they even say just simply group religious activities, like I was saying up front. Okay, you can just think in terms of merely a group. It doesn't have to be, socialized, you know, literally. Right? It can just be a collective activity fostering purely the inner life, that purely love-expanding fellowship, you know, with no service-expanding aspect to it at all. You know, so in other words, it isn't socialized. You know, and in that mode, you know, to dramatize the loyalties of religion, this group phenomenon of just that mutual edification of interacting with individuals who find their ultimate stability in life to an inner loyalty, not some outer loyalty. Right? To have that, to dramatize that, in other words, to have that be manifest, to play out and hence observable. Right? You can see the fruits of that fact. You know, literalness of, you know, the word drama is to do. Right, you know, to act out, right, to express it out, you know, and then you know, again, you know, think about how inner life it is for them to say to magnify the lures of truth, beauty, and goodness. It has nothing to do with service. To foster the attractions of supreme values. Again, nothing to do with service, purely inner. You know, and even using the word attraction there makes it all, you think all the more physically about spiritual gravity, right? You know, and with, by saying attraction, yep.
So, I went to our church's Christmas Eve service, worship service this year, and there's 3 to 4 times as many people came to that service than what usually show up on a Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, most of those people, by definition, don't even belong to the church. But they came for that service, and it was a beautiful service. I don't remember anything that was said particularly, but it was people apparently were getting what they came for. And
mm-hmm.
it was... There was no hope. They didn't have to come back Sunday and sign up for the mission commission or
right.
mission committee.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's. You know, there, if you reflect on it, there's aspects of most churches that. You know, that are more dedicated to the inner life. You know, the problem is, you know, more and more, you know, there's everyone has kind of lost conscious sight of that, and it's kind of only there because of tradition, you know. And so one of the things, see, that can be done is to kind of get that back out, you know, bring it up, put it before your eyes again, dust it off, you know, and recognize why that's there. Maybe think about making it a little less rote and ritualistic, but to appreciate that, you know, it's a reminder that fundamentally this group was supposed to be about the inner life and not about the outer life. And then as you go to the next one in that list, says to enhance the service of unselfish fellowship. Okay, they've just mentioned service, but notice that how they worded it. That you know you can, you know, if you can't get to a group that can is sort of purely separated from service. Which basically you can't right now, you can at least remind people that what this group is about is not the literal service itself, but enhancing. You know, the literalness of enhance means to put more altitude into it. You know, and the enhance part is altitude. Okay, put more altitude into it. See, so you know, a religious group can work on producing individuals that are enhanced, you know, that have a higher starting level within them So as those individuals go out to serve, you know, it's you can visualize it literally, like how much more work water can do if you start it flowing downhill from a higher altitude, right? From a higher elevation in that case, right? So that, you know, see the way they word that? You know, you're not necessarily doing the service as a group, but you're in, you know, you're seeing to the enhancement of that service when they do go out into a service group. Yep.
What is unselfish fellowship? It seems like it's selfless, right? Fellowship.
Right. I mean, the service, you know, of unselfish fellowship just means you're going to go out to your fellow man with no expectation of something in return, which means, you know, as we've talked about many times, if you think about the physics of that, you know, okay, how far do you have to move someone up the levels of meaning for them to go out like that? You know, let's just quickly remind ourselves of how that works with the levels of meaning. On the first level of meaning, the arrow is pointing in at you, and that's it. It's me, 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 right? And in an initial developmental sense, on that first level, that's a level of selfishness. Okay? You move it up one notch, and you go, okay, well, the arrows are still going to be pointing in, but it's only fair, right? You go up to the level of fairness, the second level. It's only fair that we share the inner arrow. I'll let the arrow point at you, but this is a mutual thing. You got to let it point at me, too, you know, equally. Anything else wouldn't be fair, right? See, so sharing that, you know, so that, you know, mutual, you know, aspect has been added, but it's still an inward pointing arrow. Okay, then you take it up to the third level of meaning, and the arrow disappears. It goes to a point. It's not pointing outward yet, but it's not pointing inward anymore. You know, that's the level, you know, where of transition. You're transitioning from inward arrows to outward arrows. You go up to the fourth level of meaning. That's the level of kindness. There, so the arrow is pointing out now, but it's a mutual thing. It's kin-like, kind, right? You'll sacrifice, you know, for the sake of your kin. Yeah, but that kin person, you know, knows that, okay, I'm going to point the arrow at you, but, you know, remember, yeah, you got to point it at me in return. Right? The arrows are outward, but it's, you know, there's still a demand for mutuality. You go up to the fifth level of meaning. Okay, now the arrow is also pointing out, but there's no mutuality involved in it. You'll just give, expecting nothing in return. No, it's not that mutual self-sacrifice of the family, of kin anymore. It's this. See, so there's a direct way, okay, I can move up out in altitude and meaning, okay? And Jesus said, where are we when we come together in our churches? And we still are that way 2,000 years later. You're on the second level of meaning. Right, the best you've got to offer is a reverence on the second level of meaning, that level of the feelings, and in terms of your relationship with others, it's just that fairness thing. Okay, it needs to. So you need to get people lifted up. See, and if it's actual love expanding fellowship, that means you've lifted them all the way up to the sixth level of meaning, where you transcend arrows completely. Right? Arrows are relative to self, pointing away from it or pointing towards it. You transcend self completely. Right? Transcendent of selflessness is godlikeness on the sixth level of meaning. Right? If you actually get them up to that personal realization of divine fellowship in this religious group, which is what you should be doing, then, see, step two is reminding them that they can apply that love on the level of mercy. They can apply that love down on the fifth level of meaning and go out in unselfish fellowship, like they're saying here. Okay. But you know, you've got a lot of work to do. And Jesus said, "I would lead you up, right? Up from that level of awe and reverence, the second, you know, up to recognition and realization and appreciation to love." Right? That's what a religious group should do, is lift you up from where you kind of just top out, you know, just sloshing around, you know, with your fellow man in a natural way. It takes some help to be fostered above the second level of meaning, above the level of the feelings. The naturalness, just doesn't take you any further up. Yeah. Yep.
It feels a little bit intellectually like a ride in Trump Towers on the elevator. Learn government workers, I watched them ride the elevator, and that's how they did their law. It's like the higher they got above their boss, mm-hmm. then they have precedence. So it feels a little bit like that. So there's certain arrows pointing this way, and then you get above the self, and then you're not worried about worldly concerns. Or it seems a little bit like maybe you on peace camp talk, where you're in a camp and people are dying. Do you get what I'm saying? I'm trying to make a reference point into the relevancy of what you're saying.
I mean, all I'm trying to do is add, you know, is to sort of just add in the recognition that if you really, really want to help your fellow man, mm-hmm. They need more than what they have. So if you're just like them, you have nothing to offer them that they don't already have. The only way to actually improve your fellow man is for you to have allowed spiritual gravity to lift yourself, you know, to lift you up within, so you can bring that which you've acquired down to them, and foster that growth upward in them. I mean, you know, if you're just exactly where they are, you know, if a parent is just as fearful as a child, can the parent help the child with its fear? No. The parent will make the child's fear worse. Right? If the child is wide-eyed with fear, and then he looks to mom or dad, and mom is even worse, right, because she even has a greater scope, you know, to put her fear into, okay, then they're both going to die. Right? It's not that you're saying that you're better than someone else. You've been grown. You didn't build yourself better. You know, this is getting into the next paper, beginning of the next paper. Allowing yourself to be grown up. So you're a grown-up, right? And you actually have something that that person in need doesn't have. You know, in an objectivity, for instance, that they don't have, that they really could benefit from. Someone who isn't flailing around like they are because they lack the objectivity. So you don't go to them thinking, well, I'm better than you, and so I can help you. I mean, a parent doesn't say that to themselves when they help their child. And this is why parental experience is so important, so that you can kind of just learn this in the trenches. Right? You know, there's no self-aggrandizement in a genuine parent when they approach their child, but they are above the child. We look to Jesus as someone who can help us because we believe, or maybe we know, that he's above. Right? Now, as we point out, what we're trying to do with the fifth epical revelation is not to imagine that he's above us because he's a fetish man, but to recognize he's above us as a true man who's been growing all the way up to the top, but can still reach down to where we are, a fetish man can't. A fetish man can't relate to us, right? But a true man can, and he can we can benefit from the heights that he's embodied within himself as a fully developed mortal. That's why you can look you can look to him for guidance as an example. I mean, that's all we're trying to do, you know, is just we all need to foster that. If I have the faith of Jesus, in other words, if I have genuine human faith, I can help any child of God. Because a mere child of God doesn't have that kind of genuine faith. They're too immature yet to have grounded themselves consciously in eternity like that. But if I have that grounding in eternity, if I genuinely have that, then nothing can shake me. And no matter what troubles a child of God is going through, if I step into where they are, I won't be caught up in it like they are. I will stand unmoved in their storm, and I can actually help them. Right? And there's no self-aggrandizement in your mind, right? There's the only way to get up to these real levels is through humility, right? People who think they're above others pridefully really aren't, right? Because there is no upper level predicated on pride. That's a delusion. The higher you go, the more humble you are, really, if you're really going up. So see, there's no possibility, if you really are, developmentally ahead of the person you're trying to help. You know, if you've moved up a bit, you're not going to be engaging them in that inappropriate self-aggrandizing way.
And you're both children of God, and God loves you both the same. There isn't a pecking order that way. You're just more, you have the potential to be more helpful, more valuable, more insightful, more wise, those things.
Yeah, exactly, because we were talking about moving up levels of meaning, right? It has nothing to do with, you're spiritually equal. The adult of God is spiritually equal to the child of God. But, in terms of meaning, in terms of wisdom, in terms of mind, right, you've moved way up above where you started and where they still are. I mean, that the whole ascension career is not, throughout that whole exaltation, if you will, that whole moving up, spiritual equality is unchanged. You're spiritually equal at the bottom and at the top and all the everywhere in between. That doesn't change. But in terms of your relationship to the cosmos, in terms of wisdom, right, you're moving up. That's what the ascension career is about, is levels of wisdom, not levels of betterment in the eyes of the spiritual father. Your psychic circle development inward, if you visualize it vertically, it's not spiritual levels that you're moving up. It's cosmic levels you're moving up. So, we'll actually get to this in the next paragraph a little bit. This whole bit of pride entering in, where you think you're spiritually better than someone else. All right. Okay, but then flip through these a little bit. They go on there. Okay, so after you've enhanced the service of unselfish fellowship, you've got that very key thing of the family is the foundation of all human institutions. A well-formed institutional religion should see to the glorification of the potentials of family life. And that's not the job of the government or whatever, right? Or some social organization. That's an activity for the religious group to hold up that, the nobility of the family as the nucleus of all civilization. Yep.
What about the idea of, so you're talking about going up cosmically,
mm-hmm.
and I can see that in maybe hotel sanitation, where you have a skyscraper and there's people showering, like logically, right, in each level, and a building doesn't fall apart. You know, we have to make sure the air circulates and the sanitation works and water flows. So there's this logical thing about having this, you know, tier upwards. But what about the other thought besides sanitation? What about people not wanting to change their role in life? So somebody would not want to cosmically turn into some higher evolutional Pillsbury Doughboy, so to speak. Do you know, what I'm trying to say is that staying happy and content in the life you're given. That concept, if you
will. Okay, well, okay, first of all, let me just comment on your initial analogy you were using there. I mean, that's not a cosmic thing you were talking about there. That's just material pragmatism you were talking about there. The cosmic in the Arantia book is you have material pragmatism on the one side, spiritual idealism on the other side, and you bring those together in a super additive consequence. Okay, now that all sounds very abstract and intangible, but even if you don't understand initially what cosmic consciousness is, it's important to recognize it's above pragmatism, it's above idealism, it's a holistic sense that includes all of the practical issues and all of the issue of ideals. In other words, it takes into account all the facts and all the ideals, okay, and it goes up, puts those together into what's genuinely wisdom. You know, wisdom isn't just precise pragmatism, like some humans think it is. Wisdom is something much greater than precise pragmatism. It has just as much ideal as it does the practical, factual issues involved. Okay, so there's that aspect. But to your greater point, our natural animal origin nature doesn't see itself as ascending. It doesn't see itself as progressing. And that's why most of humanity is in this mode where they're quite content to just keep things the way they've always been. That's our basic evolutionary stock speaking. We didn't get a lot of biologic uplift. So, in general, mankind doesn't think very much in terms of actually being an ascending phenomenon in the universe. So there's this tension on the planet between a handful of people that want to progress things, you know, and they're kind of vaguely recognizing they want to progress them upward. In tension with a tendency within them and a lot of people at large beyond them that don't want to progress at all. If you introduce the idea of progression to them, they might actually see that as evil because they've they've incorporated the idea of no progress into their religious conscience, into their dogma. You know, and they see those peoples on the planet that are constantly wanting to move things forward as evil. You know, their sense of God is that God wants you to stay the same. You know, and they may even go beyond their religious dogma. They may believe that there is no vertical thing in terms of a future. They may believe that there's something after death, but it's not something above. It's something to the side, right? A whole reincarnation idea where you're just going, you know, you're playing around in the plane in different ways, you know, just forever. You're never ascending. See, again, that's our natural animal origin sense of ourselves. And so this is one of the difficult things about, you know, what we're talking about in the book here. The book is very much elaborating that the real universe is an ascension scheme. But a lot of the people on this planet, that just doesn't do anything for them. You know, this book is not meant to try to somehow pound that into them. They're fine the way they are right now. This book is not a dispensational revelation. It's not meant for everyone. It's meant for those who they feel kind of inside, they feel kind of trapped in a go-nowhere, not an advancing, at least inner life, and they'd like to be liberated from all of their social structures that are telling them, no, you have to be happy, quote-unquote, with the things staying the way they are. And it's good news. It's like, no, you don't have to somehow put yourself in that sort of intellectual bondage. You can't be in rebellion against your society. you can't demand that the society move upward when it really can't. But you inside can move upward. And this is kind of what we're just getting at here. If I let go of that outer boat anchor that doesn't want to progress, and I actually allow myself to move upward within, if I allow myself to be grown, when I do interact with the people in my society, I will inject a little bit of leaven, right, in the dough out there. You will be a little bit of an uplifting influence. There will be some people out there that will have a little bit of curiosity. They will notice that you seem to have a stability that they don't have. And they might ask you about it, and you can testify that you've allowed yourself to take a hold of the spiritual gravity within, and it's lifted you up, and you've found a stability within yourself that you didn't know you had before. And they go, that's really cool. I'm going to try that too. It's like, well, what are the favorable conditions for that? Again, we're getting to the next paper, right? And you can explain to them, well, you need to be loyal. You need to be humble. You need to be sincere. You need to be just. And you need to be patient. And it's, well, yeah, but how do I build it? No, there's nothing to build. You're going to be grown. You're not going to do it. The God of growth is going to do it. But you need to supply the favorable conditions. You need to let go of the things that are preventing you from being lifted up within, from being grown. You know, and the fruits of a greater inner life are automatic. Right? You'll be manifesting these fruits. You're encouraging someone to move up. They'll be and eventually, the society will move up. But no one is going to try to just be some benign dictator and haul everyone up or something, you know, because that doesn't work. You know, if nothing else, the moment that you die and let go of it, it all falls back down again. Right. See, so this is, you know, we have to respect that there's billions of people on the planet that we're not talking about here. Right? They're where they are, and that's not going to change for thousands of years. But a few people can begin to pull themselves out of that limiting system and let gravity grow them, let themselves be lifted up within, and we'll see what happens. Maybe there won't have to be an interregnum then. Maybe civilization won't collapse, because all you need is a few. Right? Any society, it doesn't even need 1% of the members of that society to have a little bit of cosmic consciousness to prevent things from collapsing. So it only takes a few. And that's what, you know, the book is here to encourage those who to be those mustard seeds.
Chris, can you say that those who want to preserve the status quo, conservatives, you know, they want to conserve
Preservatives want to.
Conservatives versus liberals who are open to change and growth and stuff.
Yeah, that's a great example right there, yeah. How we don't. We think that a conservative is a word that describes someone who doesn't want things to change. That's not what the word conservative means. As I injected in there, that's a preservative. See, that's a fundamentalist. I mean, as I pointed out, you know, the Latins coined three words. Preserve, that's about the past. Observe, that's about the present. Conserve is about the future. A genuine, the Nature Conservancy. Why did they call it the Nature Conservancy? Because they started it as a group that were future oriented, and it's flipped around and it's become the Nature Preservancy now, where you're trying to preserve nature, which is impossible. Right? I mean, a genuine conservationist, a genuine conservative, is someone who is definitely looking towards the future. And an evolutionary changing process, but they're the ones in the society that know that as we move forward, there's some things that we've developed in the past that we don't want to let go. They're foundation stones. Everything else can change. See? So you're not preserving the past, you're conserving. The con means with. There's a few things you're going to take with you as you go forward into the future. The degree to which this is not consciously recognized is the degree to which anyone that's called calls themselves a conservationist or a conservative isn't anymore. Right? They've become preservationists, preservatives. Okay? They aren't what they call themselves anymore. A conservative is liberal. A real conservative is liberal. See, this is, we have these absurdities of dichotomies, that there's no truth to them. What you're supposed to, what you initially were meaning by someone that you were calling a liberal, you were called that simply because it was in such contrast to an ecclesiastical preservative environment. Okay, but in a more genuine sense, what that person is not really a liberal. What they are is a person, they're the person in society that wants to really focus on not what we need to take with us from the past so that we have something to stand on, but they're the ones that are focused on the progress itself. Okay. Yeah. Remember, there's two groups of Master Seraphim that help these two groups of potential two groups of humans. There's the progress angels that help, they're there to help those people on the planet that want to really see to, you know, the actual progress itself, you know, and they aren't keeping their eye on the ball of what you know, need to be carrying forward with you. And then there's the religious guardians. Right? Those are the ones who see to the conservation of what the evolutionary process has produced in the past and make sure it isn't lost as we progress. You know, and as I point out all the time, even when you're talking about master seraphim, the progress angels don't just need a check and a balance in the religious guardians. They need checkmates, because it's very easy for progress to get ahead of itself, and you'll lose what you're standing on. The moment you lose what you're standing on, it doesn't matter how much velocity you have in terms of progress, you fall. Right? So, you know, those religious guardians literally can tell the progress angel, stop. You know, we're getting overplayed on progress. You know, and someone who's really animated about progress, they see those that want, you know, it's like, well, that's bad. You're holding back progress. It's like, no. I'm just making sure that we don't progress so fast that we can't carry what we need to with us. Right? I mean, think of it in simple terms with, you know, air resistance. If I'm holding something in my hand, okay, and I start moving faster and faster and faster, pretty soon I can't hold it. It flies out of my hand. The wind rips it out of my hand. Right? And the religious guardians are there to make sure that that doesn't happen. See, and think about how you know, this gets us back to where we are. Right now, institutional religion is basically not identified with the religious guardians at all, those master seraphim. It's identified with the progress angels. Okay? And to that, and that's that, you know, a church without religion, see, that's a problem. The fact that our churches are more identified with the progress angels than with their religious guardians means, see, they're not religious at all. They're not about, those churches are no longer about the conservation of the things that society needs to stand on, the foundations anymore. They're not conservatives anymore. Religionists are conservatives, right? They're seeing to it that society has, that's what a real religionist is. A real religionist is not someone who says, forget about all that stuff in the past, it's all garbage, let's just progress. That's not a religionist. That's an unbridled spiritist. This is what the book is trying to get us to understand. This is a problem with religion right now. It is not religion anymore. It's not identified with the religious guardians, the master seraphims that oversee that part of our civilization. There's no one identifying with the religious guardians anymore, practically. Right? Yeah. You know, even things that go outside of genuine relationship to the cosmos, genuine moral foundation points, like I was just saying a minute ago, you know, even thinking about forests or politics, we don't have conservationists or conservatives, you know, hardly anymore. We have all these people that are not properly oriented on the future like they should be.
Preservative or the so-called liberal, they're both going nowhere.
Right, it's just,
one's going fast and one's not going at all.
It's just not what we see. And so, you know, that's one thing, you know, as you read about the nature of religion here, as you go through these five papers, it should slowly dawn on you. It's like, well, wait a minute. I've gotten totally suckered into thinking about religion in a completely false way. Religion isn't about unbridled progress. It isn't about pushing social justice as fast as you can. That's not what religion is about. Religion, the religionists in the society are supposed to be the ones who are saying, no, wait a minute. We're going too fast. We're going to lose our foundation points here. We need to bring forward with us, we need to conserve certain things. Right? They're supposed, you know, but obviously there's a tendency for a religion, if he sees himself that way, to start to become a static instead of a dynamic phenomenon. Like I said, and then he becomes a preservationist, see, instead of a conservationist, right?
They have great shelf.
Like, you know, he's got to think more dynamically about this, about what you're holding on to, right? You've got to hold on to the truth of it. You can't literally hold on to the fact of it, because then you're a preservationist. Yeah. So, okay. And you can see we've got some of that right here. If you continue on in this list here, so after the family life there, so you to promote religious education. So you, when you think about that, it's like, okay, now that's getting a little bit of a socialized sort of a phenomenon. Yeah, like I said, see, this list isn't just pure inner life stuff, but it had a bunch of solid inner life things at the beginning. See, so that as you get into things like education and stuff, it doesn't lose sight of, you know, what is all predicated on, you know, the inner life.
Cosmic morals.
To provide wise counsel and spiritual guidance. See, and again, notice it's wise counsel, like I was saying, you know, this is wisdom. You know, and to encourage group worship. So, you know, in the best there, right, worship in a pure sense is purely an individual fact. It's when you go all the way up to the sixth level of meaning and you're synchronizing with the cosmos in a deity sense that would allow you to have that connection to the universal Father of adoration. You know, it's not some outer life ritual, but, you know, they're pointing out, you know, even if you do have some outer life ritual thing that you're calling worship, try to make it less about the ritual and more about a mutual encouragement to have that inner life genuine worship fact going on, you know, and it's more of, each individual is in that state, and you're doing it in a group. Right? So the individual is first, and the group is second. You know, rather than just doing some fancy emotional thing as a group and hoping that somehow that causes you to have something inside. Yep.
So to me, I'm thinking of to me, that seems so in a group, worship in a group, it's mass consciousness, right? So you have maybe the projects of mass consciousness, which is considered the Nabisco white cracker. Because, why? Because this group of population never got educated, and they couldn't get to worship. They stayed within that schizophrenic bubble. So the mass consciousness is very different than when you're on wine and a wafer, whether that's liked or not, than being in the mass consciousness of the societal propagation of maybe Ritalin-like attitudes.
I mean, you're just, you know, to delight in sharing this inner life experience with others, you know, is fundamentally what they mean by that group worship. I mean, it's just to know that you're not alone, you know, is beneficial, to have that interplay that to help each other stay in and up. Now, you're just doing this as a group. You're not going out with this at all. See, you know, this is just something you come together to do, to share, and then you go out into the world, sort of reinforced inside, with that. See, that's that. You know, that's that love expanding fellowship aspect. You know what they fundamentally mean by that group worship. It's nothing to do with outer life. Has nothing to do with service. And if you can make it as little ritualized, which is an outer life thing, as possible, all the better. Exactly what we're talking about, you know, that's up to us to figure out as groups and stuff. But that's what they're encouraging. All live religions encourage human friendship. And again, remember the word friend means love, loving. Okay, so like we talked about, so starting your relationship, inner life to inner life, not outer life to outer life, that's brethren. That's not friends. Friends are inner life to inner life. And there's the conserve morality, like I said. They're the conservators. Promote neighborhood welfare, facilitate the spread of essential gospel of their respective messages of eternal salvation. So now that last one, you're going, okay, now that is sounding very much kind of evolutionary religion, where every evolutionary religion has some notion of salvation. It doesn't sound like where we're supposed to be, where we take our salvation for granted. Yes, but notice it says eternal salvation. So an improved religious group, it can still talk about salvation, but fostering less thinking about temporal salvation, where you're worried about, you know, surviving to a next life, right? To think more in terms of fostering a part of you that is saved relative to eternity. You know, to think of that word salvation a little bit more literally. When you move your mouse on your computer, you know, and select save, are you thinking, okay, what I'm doing with this computer is in a state of debt relative to God. It's sinful, and I'm redeeming it. I'm saving it. No, that's not what you're thinking. Right, it's literally you've got something, you know, that you're saving to the hard drive, say. Okay, think about salvation, you know, eternal salvation, in that literal way. The whole point is to foster having something that can be copied, saved onto a hard drive, as it were. Yeah, saved into your moronchous soul. Right? You know, what's in the upper domain right now is like what's in RAM on your computer. The moment that you shut it off, it disappears. The moment you die, that disappears. It's not saved. Right? And if you haven't selected save, that's an issue. Right? When the computer, you know, the power goes off, the computer dies. Right? There's a physics to this. You want to think about salvation literally like that. You know, to foster that there's something that the adjuster can copy from that upper domain over onto a foundation, a substance that doesn't shut down when you die, so that it's saved. And when you power back up again on the first mansion world, it's still there. Just like what's on the hard drive is still there when you shut down the computer and turn it back on again. And you can bring it back into RAM and work with it actively again.
And the autosave is not going to do that? My
phone has autosave. It's amazing. Since Pentecost, there's an autosave of that bit you've been given by grace. You've got an embryonic soul by grace. Okay? But if you want to wake up with more than that embryonic soul, then you need to take delight in cultivating, having something more to save. You know, you're given that whole upper domain with something that's of the cosmos, it gets saved automatically. Okay, and if you don't put anything more cosmic-like up there, if what you do instead, like you're saying, if you drag dogma in and put it up there, I mean, do you really want that dogma to be saved? No. See, I mean, and it's not. I mean, only that which conforms to the cosmos is going to get saved. So you need to take a delight in cultivating, bringing more of the cosmos down and in. That's growth, right? The growth is when the cosmos is in, you know, embodied within that upper domain more, and there's more to save now. See, and it's eternal salvation because, you know, that that Marantia brain, that soul, has spirit substance in it. It's bound back to eternity. Right? So you're, you know, it's indelible. Yep.
So knowing the truth and living the truth. And cosmic. Aren't those things that are up there that we are seeking? Striving for?
Yeah, I mean, that's you know, the stuff of the upper domain. It begins with knowing the truth. You know, that's followed by obeying the truth. And that's culminated in thinking the truth, right? Which is genuine worship. Thinking the truth is that dynamic synchronization with the cosmos, the wholeness of the cosmos. Yeah. See, and again, all that should sound like, that doesn't sound like the word truth in the dictionary. Of course it's not the word truth in the dictionary. See, we're talking about something that's not in the dictionary. When we're talking about this knowing and obeying and thinking, right? It's a dynamic thing that you can't look up in a dictionary. It's what the word truth is supposed to be applied to. And it's innately of the cosmos, and it's innately stuff that gets saved, and the more you spin it up, the more dynamic it becomes. As you think of going from knowing to obeying to thinking, all right. Well, what about this great big list of issues?
But as religion becomes institutionalized, its power for good is curtailed, while the possibilities for evil are greatly multiplied. The dangers of formalized religion are fixation of beliefs and crystallization of sentiments, accumulation of vested interests with increase of secularization, tendency to standardize and fossilize truth, diversion of religion from the service of God to the service of the church, inclination of leaders to become administrators instead of ministers, tendency to form sects and competitive divisions, establishment of oppressive ecclesiastical authority, creation of the aristocratic chosen people attitude, fostering of false exaggerated ideas of sacredness, the routinization of religion and the petrification of worship, tendency to venerate the past while ignoring present demands, failure to make up-to-date interpretations of religion, entanglement with functions of secular institutions. It creates the evil discrimination of religious castes. It becomes an intolerant judge of orthodoxy. It fails to hold the interests of adventurous youth and gradually loses the saving message of the gospel of eternal salvation.
And in the same way as the previous ones, he was eternal salvation. And of course, all those people out there saying, I'm spiritual, not religious. I mean, the basic thought in their head, of course, is this paragraph. I don't want to have anything to do with all that dead crap there. Okay, and that's an appropriate first step. Okay, but you know, once you say I don't want dead institution, which is what you mean by religion, yeah, but you must possess real religion. Okay? Just because this hyper-institutionalized, you know, even and hence evil, like they're saying, phenomenon now. It's not about goodness anymore. It's actually flipped the sign. It's actually a phenomenon that disrupts relationship to unity rather than fosters relationship to unity. It's evil. Just because that exists doesn't mean there isn't real religion. You know, and it certainly doesn't mean that you can go anywhere without real religion. I mean, if you don't have a real religious nucleus, then there is no saving that happens. Right? I mean, the saving mechanism is a thought adjuster, a fragment of God. You know, if you have no real relationship to the real God, right, you have no relationship to the real saving mechanism. Right? Nothing is going to, all you're going to have is what was, like I said, was put there by grace, that little embryonic soul that you'll wake up with on the first mansion world. You won't have any clue that you lived this life at all or anything, right? You'll kind of just start fresh. And you'll look up this life in the records. And all those things, like, you know, this is a huge list. We're obviously not going to go through this. Like I said, it's a gigantic list here. But remember, we mentioned things like the aristocratic chosen people attitude. That's that, you know, you're not lifting yourself up in pride. I'm a chosen person. Now, therefore, I can help you, right? Like I said, I mean, if you really have gone up, you're humble. And that's sort of, you know, quote-unquote aristocratic. It doesn't mean that there isn't really better and even best. It's just because a lot of people claim to be the best doesn't mean that there isn't really the best. You know, there's a divine aristocracy in the universe. But it's not, you know, prideful, delusional, presumptuous humans, right? Who call themselves the supreme leader or something, right? How problematic, how long that list is. I mean, how difficult it is to tell anyone out there that there's real religion. All they can think of is this long list. When you say religion, I mean, the word religion is so poisoned by this, crystallization and whatnot, like they're saying here. All those things, like they're saying, where it's become they've become preservationists instead of conservationists. You actually see them, pointing that out directly in that list. I mean, the first challenge is with yourself. When you're reading your Rancho book and you see the word religion, is there something besides that that comes to mind? And if you can finally get out of that old wineskin, get yourself above all of that unfortunate thing that's called religion now, can you find anyone else out there that you can relate to with that? If you talk about an inner life, instead of this ridiculously frozen outer life ritualistic thing, that's called religion. I mean, does it mean anything to them?
Yep. Jesus asked his disciples, who is greater, the one who serves or the one who is being served?
Mm-hmm.
He said, of course, the ones who are being served. But he said, but I'm here as a one who serves,
mm-hmm.
and the greatest among you are the one who is the servant of all.
Right.
The humbleness.
The humbleness.
Rather than
exactly
this hierarchy within religion.
Yeah, and chosen people, of course. Yeah. He was talking to the prototype, chosen people, as it were. Or maybe the archetype, chosen people. And that, and again, the fourth epical revelation is about love and service. But, you know, again, we're reminding ourselves here that you can't blur those two together, right? They're telling us if you want a really advanced service, you need an you don't want a single institution dedicated to love and service, because you're going to lose the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two, right? Between an inner life and an outer life. Service is outer life, love is inner life. Beneficial service in the outer life is generated by an inner life predicated on love, personal realization of divine fellowship. And so Jesus talked about service, but, you know, you don't want to think Jesus was saying your religious group should be a service group. That's not what Jesus was saying. Right? He was just reminding you, if you actually have a love-expanding fellowship, if you have a genuine religious group, remember, they pointed out that the initial followers of Jesus were that. They weren't a service group. But it didn't take, you know, a couple centuries forward, and, you know, it became more and more just a service group. But he's reminding you that you should have this love-expanding fellowship, this religious group comes together just for that, transcendent of all economic, political, and social issues, and fosters the establishment of genuine inner lives, a genuine spiritual nature. And you, when you go out, the fruits are automatic. You will serve. You won't have to spin up service. If you have a genuine inner life, there's no turning off service. It's an automatic consequence of the dynamic nature of a real inner life. A real inner life isn't that passive bliss thing that some people think it is. That's not a real inner life. You know it isn't, because it's so static. And it doesn't automatically produce fruits of service. Bliss is all about you and your spiritual experiences, right? Yep.
Failure to update. That'll get your hard drive in trouble really fast.
Yeah, failure to update.
Analogy. It's interesting.
Yep.
We have all this technology that can't escape certain patterns and kind of reflect back some things, you know, for a few of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of fun that way.
Mm-hmm. It forces logical connections when we can, point to things like that.
It's huge.
Okay. Yeah.
It's really fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just no matter how much we talk about the glories of the hourglass analogy and in the upper domain of that, remember, that whole thing is RAM. Okay?
Yeah.
That whole thing just disappears the moment you die, okay? Yeah. You've got to there's got to be a save mechanism some way, right, if you're going to go on after this life, after the computer shuts off.
That big hard drive, upgrade in your hardware with nothing to run. That's kind of unfortunate.
Yeah. So, like you said, it's a very fun analogy to play with, because it makes it kind of much more tangible. Just like the fact that we have, an internet, makes it easier for modern man to understand them talking about the universe communication grid, we kind of, you don't have to go back very far, and humans just really didn't have anything, any analogy to draw on, to understand what they were talking about there. Let's see, anything else we want to highlight there? Let me highlight one more. Diversion of religion from service of God to the service of the church. That's one of the really painful things when you see, the so-called religious leaders on the planet, supposedly the greatest of the great. And it's like, it's all just about service of the church. It's like, where's service to God here? They're just these institutionalists. And it's very sad to see that deadness, there's just no real life in all of these great religious leaders, because they're just They're just servers of the church, of the institution. They do a wonderful job of maintaining, and preserving all the forms of the institution, but that isn't service to God. And see, it goes hand in hand with that. Where did that one they said there? Fostering of false and exaggerated ideas of sacredness. That goes hand in hand with this. You decide that service to church is service to God. Because if you keep every I dotted and every T crossed of the institution, that's what God wants of you. You're serving God, by making sure that, all the candles are lit or whatever. Right? And it's like, no, there's nothing sacred about any of this material stuff that churches do. Matter's not sacred. If matter was sacred, tornadoes wouldn't tear matter apart. Churches would never be destroyed in tornadoes or hurricanes. There's nothing sacred there. No matter how much we think there is.
I just can't help but think, this is as American as apple pie, and blowing things up at 4th of July. It's just like fundamentally speaking, this is the subject,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, let's just remind ourselves of that. This long list here of negatives, it doesn't mean that really calcified, institutionalized church hasn't had its place in the past. It has been good in the past as a part of the evolutionary process. Like we talked about the priesthood, with evolutionary religion. They have a place in the evolutionary process where they're good, but all good things taken to extreme become bad. Right? That's what they're talking about here. No longer is this a net positive phenomenon. This is a net negative phenomenon now. And it's a boat anchor holding back the cosmic growth of mankind. If there isn't some individuals on the planet that see beyond the institutions, not just see apart from the institution. There's lots of people on the planet that see apart from these institutions, demonize them, and rightly, point out on this long list of negatives, right? Okay, that doesn't help anyone. That doesn't help mankind. To just say, not that. Not that, but what? If not that, what? It's like, well, nothing. We don't need it. No, you need something. Right? You can't just be not that.
So the institutions that are there today and are, trying to be religious institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a baby in that.
Yeah, in the midst of all that bathwater.
Midst of all that. Focusing on the essentials that help create a situation to be uplifting that baby. And focusing on those parts. And just lifting that part up and being okay with the rest of it falling away or, becoming way lesser, might be the hope to their survival and being more productive.
Yeah, it's kind of like what Gene said a while back that I highlighted. A wise leader doesn't have to go in and destroy current church institutions. A wise leader, if there's any validity to it as a church institution, there are things in it that you could just shift the focus back to the more inner life aspects. And if you just gently lift those up in the congregation, right, you don't have to demonize the other, right? You don't have to go in with the scissors and cut anything out. You know, if you lift up that which is real and true, that has a spiritual gravity to it. Okay, and like you're just saying, the things that need to fade away will fade away again. Like I said, you know, they reminded us as they started this whole discussion that even, you know, if you take Christianity, right, if you went back to the early Christians, you know, in some cases before they even called themselves Christians, really, you know, but those early followers of Jesus, their group gatherings were just dedicated to the inner life. And so it didn't matter who was there. They could have completely different opinions about everything economically, socially, politically. It was utterly irrelevant because there was none of that there in the house of God. Right? Now, I mean, think about how hopeless that's getting now. I mean, people just, I mean, if they get together in a group, they've got to talk about politics. And it's impossible to have a religious group now because you've made politics God instead of God, you know? And it's so problematic. I mean, you know, we're getting to the point where we say we don't even want to, you know, if we have dating apps, it's like, I want to make sure that only people with my same political party, right, are responding to my posting. You know, we're getting where we won't even countenance different political parties in a marriage, let alone in a church. Right. We're losing all inner transcendence. We can't get above this stuff anymore. We don't have what's above that stuff within us anymore. We've let material gravity drag us totally down, right? And we're thinking in the plane totally.
Nobody can say, hey, remember when religion was pre-institutional?
Yeah.
And there's no reference point for
that. We talk about so-called conservative and so-called liberal churches now and stuff. So, you know, I mean, it's just totally not what, that's not religion, right? That's some sort of social phenomenon where those things are relative. It's not a religious group. If it was a religious group, there would be absolutely nothing to do with such things. You would never think of applying the label to, you know, slightly different subject. Instead of on the love end, it's on the law end. But you got the same issue, you know. I mean, judges are supposed to be transcendent of partisan things, right? So just like the churches see that, you know, our judges are in the same mode, it's almost impossible to find a judge that's transcendent in the legal sense, like the religion is supposed to be transcendent in the love sense, of all these social, political, and economic issues. Right? Both ends of the spectrum are collapsing, and so everything in between collapses. Very problematic what we've got going these days. All right, what's this last little footnote they put on this section?
Formal religion restrains men in their personal spiritual activities instead of releasing them for heightened service as kingdom builders.
Yeah. So just that's how they end it. It was just that simple thing, which I threw in a few times as we were talking. Right? I mean, that bondage. The only place where you're really liberated is in your inner life. That's the place where you're sovereign. Right? Formal religion drags you down out of your inner life, where you're in bondage, inescapably. I don't want to be in the galaxy I'm in. It's like, no, you're in bondage to this galaxy. This is the galaxy you're in. You don't have any option there. Right? I mean, the outer life is fixed. Basically, yep.
This short statement goes completely contrary to a point I've been trying to make to my fellow Christians.
Uh-huh.
That the kingdom of God isn't something that we build.
Right.
It's something that's already in existence. And here it's talking about kingdom builders.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Maybe I don't really know what I'm talking about.
Well,
what do they mean by kingdom builders?
They're There is a building that happens, but it's tied to those automatic fruits. I mean, so I don't build an inner life; it's grown. So, you know, and that's what you're thinking. You know, it's like, okay, I got to avoid that builder thing. Right? You're not going to build it; it's going to be grown. You're going to supply the favorable conditions. Okay, but once it's grown, fruits, there's automatic fruits of that spiritual nature, that inner life, that flow out and build, you know, a better world predicated on those inner lives. Releasing them for heightened service. You know, just look at all the words. It's just like enhance the service of unselfish fellowship. See, it's back to that. Like I said, when you set that inner life free from its bondage to an outer life, okay, then it becomes a source of a whole new outer life. Behold, all things are becoming new. Right? That's a building, right? That's happening. See, it, none of it is really you. You were grown, and this whole fruits thing is not something that you do. It happens automatically because you're encircuited. See, and it naturally flows out. Again, it's back to Melchizedek. All you have to do is just ground yourself in this, and everything else happens. Trust and faith, right? Ground yourself in genuine faith, right? And there's a whole phenomenon that flows from that automatically. You know, you don't build yourself within with works righteousness, and you don't build a more serving world. I mean, all that happens naturally, predicated on real inner lives, right? And you know, this jumps way to the end of the book, you know, that first mile or second mile or thing, right? You know, why do we languish and stumble along in moral darkness? It's like, you know, why isn't there all this kingdom building happening? This, you know, this heightened service, right, as kingdom builders. You know, why isn't that happening? Why are we languishing, right? It's because there aren't any real inner lives. If there were, there wouldn't be any languishing. You can't turn it off. It's automatically manifests the fruits.
Right? What we're building is the first sentence. Disease and enslavement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are the fruits that we're trying to work with to do some kind of service or some kind of anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't even highlight the fact, you know, they said danger and things like that and evil. Right. I mean, see, you know, like I said, you're setting up these things that you don't want to be dominated by. They're actually disrupting of your relationship to unity, these things that you're setting up that dominate your mind. It's like, well, how did they dominate my mind? Well, you unfortunately pulled them in and drug them up and put them there in the dominant position instead of the cosmos. So you get what you put there.
Isn't it better to sell all the churches and distribute it among the homeless?
Yeah, and of course that gets kind of back to civilization. There has to be institutions. If you just pour all of the wealth out into the masses, it all just disappears, right? We think that somehow, wealth is some reality that will just stay out there. It's like, no, it evaporates, right? Wealth is a construct of civilization. It's not something that's just, you know, laying out there in the dirt and you dig it up. Right? I mean, gold is not wealth. Wealth is an abstract construct of civilization, right? And only those that know how to conserve wealth can keep it going. If you put it in the hands of those who don't even know what it is, it just evaporates, right? All right, let's see if we can do this last section here.
7, religion's contribution. Though churches and all religious groups should stand aloof from all secular activities At the same time, religion must do nothing to hinder or retard the social coordination of human institutions. Life must continue to grow in meaningfulness. Man must go on with his reformation of philosophy and his clarification of religion.
Again, just notice how they're helping us think about the evolutionary process of this. You know, they remind you up front, okay, like we've said a million times already tonight, that the pure religious group is purely an inner life fact, okay? It stands aloof from all secular activities. It's secular. It's not about time. It's about eternity, okay? But that doesn't, you can't just snap your fingers and boom, you've got that. You get that more and more through an evolutionary process and this interplay, like they're reminding you at the end, this clarification of religion. You try as best you can to separate and to hold it separate, but the greater civilization system helps to clarify, oh, wait a minute, I thought I'd, but I didn't totally separate it. That actually should be out there as a separate institution. And you go back and forth. And the reminding is that reformation of philosophy. More and more you get this spherical context that science and religion exists in. And the more that you have that spherical philosophic context, the more you can clarify science, the more you can clarify religion, right? The more they can become true science and true religion in that sphere of truth, right? And so they're, we'll get into finer later papers. They talk about that stuff a lot, the main point is that whole social coordination of human institutions. There is a coordinated system, in that spherical frame, and the parts evolve in the context of that system over time and improve in their precision of expression, and they become more and more clarified, more and more. Well-focused with time. But it kind of is driven forward by, up front that religion, should be just, when all is said and done, purely about the inner life, and you're just trying to get your recognition of the inner life separated from the outer life more and more, right? And you think you've done it, and you haven't yet. You go, oh, wait a minute, that's still outer life. That's not inner life yet. It clarifies with time.
Okay. Political science must effect the reconstruction of economics and industry by the techniques it learns from the social sciences and by the insights and motives supplied by religious living. In all social reconstruction, religion provides a stabilizing loyalty to a transcendent object, a steadying goal beyond and above the immediate and temporal objective. In the midst of the confusions of a rapidly changing environment, mortal man needs the sustenance of a far-flung cosmic perspective.
Yeah, so they're starting to speak in these kind of greater, more philosophic terms, as I just said a minute ago. They're foreshadowing, they go forward with subsequent papers here. I think I'll just leave most of it at that right now. But the one thing that I'd like to highlight there is, we were talking about this last week. Notice they're wanting you to visualize again that spectrum where there's science on one end, religion on the other end, okay? And as I move from religion towards science, I get society. And as I move more towards science, I get politics, and then all the way to science. Science, politics, society, religion. That's the spectrum going from individuality institutions on the one end to unity institutions on the other end. Okay, with a gradation in between. See, and they just referred to that. Okay, economics and industry, it's on the science end. Right, see? And see, political science must affect the reconstruction of economics and industry. Right, that's what's right next to science on the spectrum. Right, and then they say behind that, see, the techniques it learns from the social sciences, right, and then behind that, and by the insights and motives supplied by religious living. Right? They're just reminding you. So you start, you know, the insight, the originality, the internal engines on the religious end, and then it moves through all the way to the science end. And it powers that.
There's a huge, huge grammatical spelling mistake. Political science must effect with an E. Effect is a noun. Here must be affect.
A-F-E. A-F-E. Well, that there's ways that you use affect like that too. I mean, affect, you know, A is kind of more precise, but the effect word has a bit of duality to it. That's a technical issue of grammar there that we don't need to get into right now. But but anyway, yeah. The see, and again, just notice, you know, that as the whole conservation thing, you know, what you're standing on that they're emphasizing there is a steadying goal beyond and above the immediate and temporal objective. The whole religion is about being bound back to eternity. It's that eternity predicate. And if you, in that spectrum, you start with eternity and then you move to the details of time. Okay.
Religion inspires man to live courageously and joyfully on the face of the earth. It joins passion with passion, insight to zeal, sympathy with power, and ideals with energy.
So, I mean, just a general thing there. You know, we mentioned it several times, you know, of having those two elements, whether it's material pragmatism on the one side, spiritual idealism on the other side, or maybe you just say facts and ideals, you know, it's reminding you that, you know, you sort of have all the outer life stuff just sort of innately because you're a material being right now. And if you originate a genuine spiritual nature, it steps in with that other element. And you get the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two. Now notice the details. There's three of them that say with. So you're thinking about bringing patience in parallel with passion and having an interplay between the two. Sympathy with power. Ideals with energy. But not all four of them say with, do they?
No.
It's not insight with zeal. It's insight to zeal. Why? Okay. Because that's the sort of the key foundational thing. I've referred to it before. If you recall, you've got zeal with the sixth adjutant, your religious impulse, down in the lower domain. Right, your third cosmic intuition, spiritual insight, on the sixth level of meaning, right? That level of religious consciousness. You know, rather than thinking of just putting that spiritual insight with the zeal, thinking of joining it to it. Okay? You don't want that zeal to just be playing in the raw. it needs to be grounded. When you combine insight with zeal, you get enthusiasm, genuine in-godedness, right? The godlikeness on that sixth level of meaning has been put into you, right? And it needs all that energy of that sixth adjutant to really be functioning in you. It's a powerful thing. And, you know, and remember when they went through that list with the love-expanding fellowship and all that? Remember the last one was prevention of fanaticism by the compensations of the scientific mental attitude? Okay. To get this enthusiasm instead of fanaticism when you bind insight to zeal, it's important to remember that there's three cosmic intuitions. Right? You know, and what you're, you know, you may be putting the spiritual insight, the third, you know, up front, binding to the zeal, but immediately there in triune association behind, quote unquote, the spiritual insight, the third cosmic intuition, is the other two. Most stabilizing the first, right? That basic, you know, how do they word that there? That scientific mental attitude, right? That's the first, what the first cosmic intuition brings in relation to fact and causality, right? And that objectivity. That, so you bind it to, so you fix this grounded zeal problem, but it has to be cosmically grounded, not just spiritually grounded. If you divorce the third cosmic intuition from the other two and glue them together, you get fanaticism. Right? See, and notice that there's a lot of confusion. A lot of people use the word enthusiasm as a synonym for fanaticism. And they're actually opposites, basically. It's like, you know, he's really enthusiastic. No, you mean he's really fanatical. Yeah, that's what you mean, yes. You have a comment?
It's just common for people to think that anyone who's grounded in facts is incapable of
any sort of energy, yeah, right, yeah.
And that they have to actually go to war against facts in order to be really enthusiastic.
Yeah, in order to be really enthusiastic, yes, exactly, right.
One analogy about being grounded in facts and that potentializing, creating potential and more possibilities is if you were designing something, you need to understand the facts of and parameters of all the materials and all the tools and all the what would you have? You need to understand that those in depth. You need to get all those facts straight of what the parameters are and what you have, and then when you have a deep understanding of the facts, then you can express with those tools. Then you can use those tools well and creatively, and it just can flow. You're not all hobbled by missteps
exactly. I mean, I agree. Yeah, and just to put one more bow on what Jean was saying. I mean, to be enthused, in godded. Okay, God is a fact. Okay, you can't get to the real God apart from fact. The real God is a fact, okay? He's not just, the heights of your self-aggrandizement and zeal or something, right? I mean, he's not some just overpowering emotion, right? He's a fact, right?
That's a good idea.
So, he's purely causal, right? I mean, you can't get to the real God without the first cosmic intuition, right? If you're divorced, if you believe in magic, you can't get to the real God, right? The real God is absolutely causal. The real God is absolutely a fact, right? He's not some magical, mystical notion. A causal, non-factual notion, right? Of human invention. It's all right, kind of just there to be recognized. But boy, has it not been, And just the tempering that you can kind of see when they say patience with passion, see is a lot like we were just talking about this tempering of the zeal. All right.
Man can never wisely decide temporal issues or transcend the selfishness of personal interests until he mediates.
Meditates
in the presence of the sovereignty of God and reckons with the realities of divine meanings and spiritual values.
So take that out of the flowery poetic abstractness that it appears to be in. Bring it down to ground. Okay, you're talking about Congress. Man can never wisely decide temporal issues or transcend the selfishness of personal interests unless... So, and then ask yourself, when you read the rest of that sentence, do you think, oh, yeah, Congress? unless he meditates in the presence of the sovereignty of God and reckons with the realities of divine meanings and spiritual values. Okay, and you wonder why Congress doesn't wisely decide the temporal issues or transcend the selfishness of personal interests. Mm-hmm. That's why. Okay? I mean, you know, it's become just a mindless ritual to start open a session of Congress with a prayer. It's not supposed to be a mindless ritual. Okay? It's supposed to remind you the second half of that sentence. And forget about anything happening that's worth talking about in this, you know, in this chamber, unless we are meditating in the presence of the sovereignty of God and reckoning with the realities of divine meanings and spiritual values. Without that, you know, you can't have government of the people, by the people, for the people. You're going to need some sort of despot or some sort of monarch.
In Iran, Congress starts with, after 1.5 hours of recitation of the Holy Book,
mm-hmm,
before the Congress, but then after that, they start fighting
each other. Yeah, they start throwing chairs.
Throwing chairs and shoes.
Right, and shoes. Yes. Right, it's like, yeah. So, yeah. That's what's between the lines of that paragraph, right? Okay.
Economic interdependence and social fraternity will ultimately conduce to brotherhood. Man is naturally a dreamer, but science is sobering him so that religion can presently activate him with far less danger of precipitating fanatical reactions. Economic necessities tie man up with reality, and personal religious experience brings this same man face to face with the eternal realities of an ever-expanding and progressing cosmic citizenship, presented by Melchizedek of Nebadon.
Again, just seeing the power potential of bringing those two things together, trying to somehow live with one or the other. Yeah. Not to mention what I was just talking about, fanaticism.
Yeah.
If you don't have that first cosmic intuition, fourth level of meaning, stabilization, when you fire up the third cosmic intuition a little bit, you won't get enthusiasm. You'll get destructive fanaticism. You know, and so, you know, the only thing that's prevented that fanaticism from tearing us apart is there's very few people who have actually fired up the third cosmic intuition in the name of religion. It's, you know, our primitiveness has been helpful. But the book is here because, see, the evolutionary process has moved us forward to where more and more people, even if they don't know it, are firing up, you know, the third cosmic intuition without any grounding. And so it's going to get more and more self-destructively fanatical as we go forward. I mean, is that not what you observe in the world? Right? Everything's an ism, an ever more fanaticalism. Yeah. And, you know, and even science, you know, has become fanaticism now. I mean, see, so what we call science is not sobering him like it was at the beginning of the 20th century. It's actually making things worse because what's called science is just a fanatical religious enterprise now. Right? And you throw in other fanatical quasi-religious things like secularism and humanism and globalism, and, you know, it's all just ripping us apart. You know, but like they point out, I mean, the only thing that kind of saves us, you know, to a degree in spite of ourselves is economic necessities. Tie man up with reality. But boy, we would really like to cast off reality and just follow our fanaticism to its ends, right? The only thing that keeps us from totally doing that overnight is, you know, you've got to not freeze to death or die of thirst or something, right?
Imagine if we won the war against poverty.
Yeah. Imagine if you could snap your fingers and magically, you know, not have all of these economic necessities. Oh yeah, you'd be careful what you ask for.
Right. If there's no victim.
Oh boy, right? You know, it's It's you know, we want to get to those things, but you have to do it through a process. If someone like Lucifer steps in and tries to magically snap his fingers and just liberate us from all of that, you know, grounding, you know, we don't magically go into light and life. We just become ungrounded, and it all goes to anarchy and chaos. So we have to be patient. It's a process. And
with the pills that psychiatrists gave, you know, from early elementary school.
Yeah, Ritalin, yes.
And maybe they don't feel poverty anymore.
We do lots of better living through chemistry things, you know.
Yeah.
But not to go off on any more tangents now because it's getting late. But I hope, you know, I say it a lot, but, you know, it's kind of very specifically appropriate here again, you know, especially in Section 6 there. You spend some time yourself and reflect on those huge long lists, you know, of how you understand what that item in that list is talking about, and, you know, can you think about ways that you could avoid an institution slipping into that? You know, if you're really interested in, you know, especially if you're interested in fostering some sort of a socialized religious phenomenon, you need to keep all these things in mind. If you take your eye off of any of these lists in the "but as," you know, paragraph, you know, those things will happen. You know, if you don't keep an eye on them, they just happen naturally. You know, so the list is long because you should be really sobered. It's like, wow, it's difficult. You got to have an institution. Boy, is it difficult to not have that institution go sour. You got to keep your eye on 50 balls at the same time. It's a complicated thing to avoid the pitfalls of, you know, what happens naturally with us. You know, all these things that we don't want, we naturally do to ourselves. See, that's the problem. Okay. Well, that's a great place to stop. We'll jump right into the next paper next time. And like I said, now we've got to talk about growth. We got again to get into the physics of growth, because we were sort of champing at the bit several times tonight. It's time to talk about growth and figure out what that is and, you know, and what it isn't. All right. Let's take a moment, everyone.